from the pipes back into the room.
I thought the trap was to catch stuff in case she dropped a pricey diamond ring down the drain.
It does that as well.
He moved the bucket into position under the sink, which I could see now was filled with soapy water.
Watch this.
He pulled the plug and the sink full of water drained noisily into the bucket below.
What you're looking at is step one in my new water conservation system. I can dump this bucket full of gray water in the toilet to make it flush. I can also use wastewater to irrigate my lawn.
Which is why you have a hose hanging out the bathroom window, yes?
You got it. I'll keep the tub stoppered while I shower, and then siphon the water out the window into my shrubs. Think of all the city water I can save. I probably waste a gallon every time I run the tap, waiting for the water to get hot. Last week I ordered a book on gray water use, and we'll see what more we can do.
Sounds good. Is that a new flower bed? He looked at me blankly. I saw the empty mulch bags.
Oh, no, no. The mulch bed is there for purification purposes. You can't store gray water for more than 24 hours because of the bacteria contents, so any runoff has to pass through healthy topsoil.
News to me.
And to me as well. My big shock was the water bill, which jumped sky high. I called the water department, and the woman checked the meter readings, which she swore were accurate. She says landscape irrigation is the prime culprit. Household use is minimal by comparison. The more lawn I can eliminate, the better off I'll be. For the moment, the water department is asking us to voluntarily reduce our usage by 20%. I'm hoping to get ahead of the game.
Well, I'm being careful.
I know that, and I appreciate your efforts. We still have to tighten our belts. If the city restricts us further, I want to be prepared.
You can count on me. He clapped his hands together once.
Let me change clothes and we can have supper up at Rosie's. With all this going on, I haven't had a chance to shop today, let alone cook, he said. Almost forgot to tell you, we have new neighbors.
Since when?
January 1st, from what I hear. Schallenbergers, on the driveway side. Joseph and Edna.
Good news. I knew the house was on the market, but I didn't know it sold. I'm sure the Adelsons are thrilled, I said. What's the story? Are they young, old?
No one 85 and under is old. They're retired. I just met them this morning. She and Joseph were in the backyard planting flowers on their little doggie's grave.
What happened to him?
Her. Old age. She died shortly after they arrived. I guess they'd been expecting it because they seemed to be bearing up okay. Joseph's in a wheelchair, so he doesn't get around so well. His walker's a bit of a struggle, too, when he's crossing the grass.
At least they're quiet. I had no idea anyone was living there.
She says now they're settled, they plan to spruce up the place, which it could sorely use. Their backyard used to look worse than mine. It's already looking better than it did.
He retreated down the hall on his way to his room, calling over his shoulder.
Help yourself to wine. I'll be right there.
I can wait, I said. Chapter 4. We ambled the half-block to Rosie's through the gathering dark. Streetlights had come on, forming shapeless yellow patches on the sidewalk. Once there, Henry opened the door and ushered me in ahead of him. The tavern's atmosphere was subdued, much as it had been before the place was taken over by the local sports enthusiasts, whose various league trophies still lined the shelf Rosie had had installed above the bar. The 1988 football season had been capped by Super Bowl XXIII on Sunday, January 22nd, when the 49ers defeated the Bengals by a score of 20-16. For reasons unknown, this had triggered an exodus. One week the sports rowdies were in evidence, the next they were gone. In one of those inexplicable migrations of restaurant patrons, they'd abandoned Rosie's as mysteriously as they had appeared. Almost at once, police department personnel drifted in to fill the ecological niche. Until recently, the favored hangout among cops had been the Caliente Cafe, or Cece's as it was known. Then, on New Year's Day, a kitchen fire had broken out, and by the time the fire engines arrived a scant 7 minutes later, the entire backside of the restaurant was engulfed in flames, and the better part of the structure was reduced to charcoal briquettes. There was some suggestion the devastating fire wasn't entirely accidental. But whatever the facts, the doors and windows had been boarded over and there was no talk of reopening. Rosie's was off the beaten path and less than a mile away, which made it the natural successor for those dispossessed of their watering hole. Rosie's wasn't a popular spot. The decor, if one could call it such, was too tacky to attract a sophisticated crowd, and the ambience too staid to appeal to the young. Now police officers and civilian employees stopped in after work, and plainclothes detectives from the Criminal Investigations Division had begun to frequent the place, attracted by its anonymity. The cheap prices also exerted an appeal. Absent were the chief of police, assistant chiefs, and others in upper management, which was just as well. In hopes of engendering loyalty, Rosie had purchased a popcorn machine. Napkin-lined baskets of freshly popped corn were now stationed down the length of the bar, with shakers of Parmesan cheese and garlic salt. The smell of hot oil and burnt kernels formed a pungent counterpoint to the scent of Hungarian spices that saturated the air. It was early yet, and neighborhood regulars would soon trickle in, augmented by off-duty police as the evening wore on. For the time being, the television screen was blank, and all of the overhead lights were on, illuminating the dispirited collection of mix-and-match furnishings Rosie had assembled from garage sales over the years. The second-hand chairs had wood or chrome frames with padded vinyl plastic seats, and the formica top tables were only made level through the tricky use of shims. The wooden booths that lined the right-hand wall were darkly varnished, with surfaces perpetually sticky to the touch. William was behind the bar, polishing stemware. Rosie was perched on a bar stool, consulting a collection of cookbooks that were open in front of her. There was only one other customer, and he sat four stools away from her, his back turned while he read the newspaper and sipped a glass of beer. As Henry and I took our seats, I glanced over and realized the lone man at the bar was Cheney Phillips, who worked in the homicide unit at the Santa Teresa Police Department. Cheney was roughly my age, with a dark mop of unruly curls, as soft as a poodle's coat. Brown-eyed, clean-shaven. 2 years before, we'd had what I suppose could be called a romance, though I feel compelled to put the term in quotes. While the initial sparks had never taken hold, I didn't think either of us had ruled out the possibility. Now even the most casual encounter sometimes triggered intimate images that made my cheeks color with embarrassment. I pushed away from the table, saying to Henry, "I'll be right back." "You want white wine, yes?" he asked. "I do, thanks." As usual, Cheney was nattily dressed, gray slacks, navy blazer, under which he wore a white dress shirt with an expensive-looking silk tie and shades of gray. I crossed to the bar and tapped him on the shoulder. "This is a pleasant surprise. I don't usually see you here at this hour. What's up?" He smiled. "I just finished my annual physical, for which I received a multitude of gold stars. I thought that warranted a beer."
"Congratulations. Good health deserves celebration."
He lifted his glass.
"To yours."
Cheney Phillips came from money. His father owned a number of private financial institutions in the area, while his mother sold high-end real estate. Both were perplexed when he forswore the banking business in favor of the police academy. Once on board at the STPD, he'd worked his way up from traffic to his current position as a homicide detective, where the pay was adequate but no cause for rejoicing. Still, Cheney managed to live well, which should have come as no surprise. Wealth begets wealth. Some years before, his uncle had died and left him an inheritance that he used to purchase a rambling two-story Victorian home next door to my friend Vera, whose house was its mirror twin. Rosie caught sight of me and her gaze flicked to Henry, alone at his table. She closed her cookbooks, stood, and reached for an apron she tied around her waist. Idly, I watched her move around behind the bar and pour a blackjack over ice for him. William passed her a sparkling wine glass, and she filled it with Chardonnay and placed it on the bar in front of me. The wine would be second rate, but the service was superb. She delivered Henry's whiskey while Cheney pulled out the stool next to him and patted it.
Have a seat. How have you been?
Good. As I settled next to him, I caught a whiff of his aftershave, and the familiar association set off a warning bell. I shifted into business mode. You're actually just the man I was looking for, I said. You remember the name Christian Satterfield? Convicted of 19 counts of bank robbery, according to the dispatch.
Know him well, he said. His last two jobs he targeted the bank of X Phillips.
Your father's bank? He pointed at me to confirm.
The dummy hit the same branch twice. First time he walked off with 13 grand. Second time my cousin Lucy Carson was at the teller's window as a trainee, which was bad news for him. He couldn't find the note he'd written, so he told her he had a gun and threatened to shoot her in the face if she didn't empty her drawer and fork over the cash. He handed her a canvas tote, so she did as requested, and then pressed the button for the silent alarm.
Good for her. Serves him right. The paper said a couple of tellers were so stressed out they quit.
Not her. Just the opposite. She testified at his trial, but downplayed the shooting threat. She said he was a gentleman, soft-spoken and polite. She said she only went for the alarm because she could see he was hurting and wanted to be caught. Once he went to prison, they carried on a feverish correspondence, pouring out their hearts. Her more than him. He's the kind of guy women think they can rehabilitate.
She have any luck?
Nah. She was 22 years old and fickle as they come. Last I heard, she'd taken up with a biker accused of killing his ex. Nothing like a bad boy in need of emotional support. What's your interest?
I've been asked to get a contact number for him now that he's out on parole. This is for his bio mom, who's got money to burn. She'd like to smooth his transition, should the need arise.
Nice.
I thought so myself. I left a message with one of the federal parole officers, but I don't want to sit around hoping he'll call back. I figure when the kid was arrested, he must have listed a local address, so I thought I'd start there.
I could help you with that. Back then, he was living with his mom over on Dave Levine. I'll have someone in records pull up the address. I'll call tomorrow and give you what we have.
I'd appreciate it. Can I buy you another beer?
Thanks, but I better pace myself. I'm having dinner with a friend.
Catch you later, then, I said as I slipped off the stool. I returned to Henry's table and took a seat.
What was that about?
He asked.
Work. Everything with you is work.
No, it's not. Rosie reappeared and gave us each a setup, a paper napkin wrapped tightly around a knife, fork, and spoon. She usually presented us with a mimeographed menu, which was strictly window dressing, as she told us what she was serving us and brooked no argument. She tucked her hands under her apron and rocked on her feet.
Tonight is big treat.
Do tell, Henry said. We can hardly wait.
Calf brain. Is very fresh. How I prepare is rinse and place in large bowl into what's trickling cold water from tap. I'm peeling off filament is like membrane covering. Then I'm soaking in vinegar water 1.5 hours, all the time cutting away white bits.
Henry closed his eyes.
I may be coming down with something, I said.
Me too. Rosie smiled.
Just teasing. You should see the look on you two faces. Wait, and I'm surprising you.
And surprise us, she did. What she brought to the table were plates on which she'd created a visual composition of grilled kielbasa, puffy fresh herb omelets oozing pale cheese, and 2 salads with a light vinaigrette. To one side she placed a basket of dinner rolls Henry'd made the day before. For dessert, she served us baked plums wrapped in a flaky pastry with a cap of softly whipped cream. We finished dinner, and Henry took care of the check while I shrugged myself into my jacket. We just stepped into the chilly night air when Anna Dace appeared, coming toward us through the newly minted dark. The two of us were related, though I'd be hard-pressed to define the family connection, which stretched back a generation to my grandmother, Rebecca Dace. My father was Anna's father's favorite uncle, making us perhaps second cousins. I might also be her aunt. She had her hair pulled up in a careless knot she'd secured with a clip. She wore a navy blue peacoat over jeans and military-style boots. I may have neglected to mention that she's shamelessly pretty. Not a trait I consider relevant, though men seem to disagree. She brightened when she caught sight of Henry and clutched him by the arm.
Hey, guess what? I took your advice and put my money in mutual funds. I allocated the investment over the four types you talked about.
I stared at her. Allocated? Shit. Since when did she use words of more than one syllable? She and her two siblings had come into money at the same time I did, though the source was different. I had expected all three of them to burn through the funds in a heartbeat. Being the mean-spirited creature I am, I experienced a pang of disappointment that she was exhibiting good sense. Henry said,
"Not the whole of it, I hope."
"No way. I set 20 grand aside in a separate account, so I'd have access to it. Not that I'd touch it," she added in haste.
"I'm giving you an A+, he said.
"I invested in mutual funds. How come I didn't get an A+? I interjected. Neither paid the slightest attention. When Henry realized Anna was on her way into Rosie's, he pushed the door open again and held it, allowing her to pass in front of him. As he did so, I looked up and saw a truncated slice of the interior, a vertical slat that included a narrow view across the tables to the bar where Cheney sat. In that split second, I saw him turn and catch sight of Anna. His face creased in a smile as he got up. The door closed, but the image seemed to hang in the air. Cheney's throwaway line hadn't really registered until then. Dinner with a friend? Since when was Anna Dace a friend? Chapter 5. The next morning, the office phone was already ringing as I turned the key in the lock and pushed open the door. The phone continued to ring as I crossed the outer office in giant steps and flung my bag on my desk. I was poised to snatch up the handset when my outgoing message kicked in. "The party you've dialed and the 805 area code is currently unavailable." My first thought was that this might be Christian Satterfield's parole officer, or perhaps the parolee himself. I was just about to answer when I heard Cheney's voice. I stayed my hand, which hovered in midair as he tossed off a hasty greeting, and then read aloud the phone number and the address on Dave Levine Street that Christian Satterfield had used at the time of his arrest. I picked up a pen and made a note of the information as Cheney neared the end of his recital. After he signed off, I played the message again, making certain I'd heard the numbers correctly. I opened my bottom desk drawer and hauled out the phone book again. I flipped over to the S's and ran a finger down the column. There were no Satterfields living on Dave Levine, but I found a match for the phone number under the name Victor Satterfield on Trace Avenue, which was not a street I knew. I removed the Santa Teresa street map from my shoulder bag and opened it to the full. I spread it across my desk and checked the street index. I found Trace at the axis of G on the horizontal and 31 on the vertical. The street was a block and a half long and butted right up against Highway 101. If I was correct in my recollection of the house numbers on Dave Levine, this address was no more than 5 blocks away from the one Satterfield had claimed 10 years earlier. I picked up the phone and dialed. I probably should have cooked up a ruse in advance, but sometimes action without planning makes just as much sense. And sometimes not. The phone rang 3 times and then someone picked up.
"Hello?"
Female, gravelly-voiced, and blunt. I pictured a habitual smoker over the age of 50. She'd uttered only one word and somehow managed to sound rude.
"May I speak to Chris?"
"Who?"
"Christian."
There was dead silence for a beat.
"Honey, you're not going to have any luck with that one," she said.
And then she hung up. I replaced the handset in the cradle, wondering what she meant. I wasn't going to have any luck with that one, meaning asking for someone named Chris or Christian. Or I wasn't going to have any luck with the man himself. Were women calling the house all day long and bombing out right and left? All I wanted to know was whether the number would net me one parolee. Calling again probably wasn't going to prove any more informative. I needed to settle the issue, and Hallie wasn't paying me enough to extend the task any longer than was absolutely necessary. I picked up the folder in which I'd tucked the copy of the newspaper clipping that included Satterfield's photograph. I slid the file into the outer pocket of my shoulder bag, locked the office, and trotted out to my car. I'd recently sold my 1970 Mustang, a grabber blue Boss 429, that was much too conspicuous for the work I do. I'm supposed to blend into the background, which was much easier with my current boring vehicle, a Honda so nondescript that I sometimes failed to spot it in a public parking lot. The only element common to the two cars is the overnight bag I stash in the trunk in case of an emergency. My definition of an emergency is being without a toothbrush, toothpaste, and fresh underpants. I slid under the wheel and turned the key in the ignition. I missed the resounding throatiness of the Mustang's oversized engine as it rumbled to life. It always sounded like a Chris Kraft powerboat to me. I drove to the end of the block and turned right on Santa Teresa Street, continuing 6 blocks north before I cut over to Dave Levine. I took a left and followed the one-way street south toward the ocean. I spotted Trace Avenue, passed it, and then found a parking place a block away. I locked the car and walked back. The house at 401 Trace turned out to be a small one-story frame structure on the corner of Trace and Dave Levine. A wide apron of dead grass formed an L on two sides of the property, and a plain wrought iron fence marked the perimeter. The house itself sat on a slab of poured concrete made level by a low wall of cinder block with a planting bed along the upper edge. The shrubs, like the lawn, were so brown they looked singed. The windows were sliding aluminum frame panels, tightly closed and rendered blank by lined drapes. Up close, I knew the aluminum would be pitted. The porch was small. To the right of the front door, there was an upholstered chair covered in floral cotton, blue and green blossoms on a ground of red. To the left of the door, there was a houseplant, probably fake. I crossed the street at an angle, waiting until I was out of range to pause and look back. No sign of the inhabitants. The rear of the house suggested more space than I'd imagined. I was guessing 3 small bedrooms, 1 bathroom, living room, kitchen, and utility porch. The neighborhood seemed quiet, made up almost entirely of single-family homes that had probably been built in the 1940s. A few of the cars parked at the curb were new, maybe 2 out of 15. The rest were 3 to 5 years old and in good shape. Most were American-made. This was not an area where banged-up vehicles were parked 3 deep in the driveways. The houses were well-maintained and most of the lawns were tidy, given that dead grass is so much easier to control. I returned to my car and drove around the block, this time parking on a side street to the north and perpendicular to Trace. For a while, I sat there and thought about life. I needed a vantage point from which I could keep an eye on the house. With luck, Christian Satterfield would arrive or depart, thus allowing me to confirm his whereabouts. Here's the problem with stationary surveillance, otherwise known as a stakeout. Most people arrive at a destination, park the car, and get out. Almost no one with a lawful purpose sits in a vehicle staring through the windshield at a building across the street. Sit in a car for any length of time, and you look suspicious, which means somebody's going to call the cops, and then your cover will be blown. The trick is to think of a legitimate reason to be loitering, a proposition more slippery than one would imagine. In the past, I'd feigned car trouble, which is only effective as long as some good Samaritan doesn't approach and offer assistance. I'd also faked a traffic survey, which I managed to extend for 2 days until I spotted my prey. Here, there was no point in pretending to count cars, because mine was the only moving vehicle I had been aware of since I arrived. I locked the car and proceeded on foot. As I approached the corner, I spotted 2 small businesses, a convenience store on one side and a bar and grill called Lou's on the corner opposite. The mailman, with his rolling cart, was just ahead of me on the far side of the street. Despite the chilly weather, he wore blue shorts, a matching blue shirt with a USPS patch on one sleeve, and what looked like a pith helmet. The mailboxes were stationed along the sidewalk, so instead of having to approach each house on foot, all he had to do was open the box and insert the relevant bundle of bills, magazines, and junk mail for any given address. I kept pace with him and watched when he turned the corner, moving toward the cul-de-sac where the highway cut through. I thought I might catch up with him and quiz him about the occupants of 401, but I worried the inquiry would get back to them. My mail person is a friendly gal with whom I chat from time to time. If someone came skulking around with questions about me, she'd not only stonewall the stranger, she'd tattle the first chance she had. If I wanted to know the names of the persons receiving mail at 401 Trace, all I had to do was look. I glanced at the house. No one peered out from behind the drapes, and no one emerged to collect the mail, so I took the liberty of lowering the flap. I removed the mail and sorted through the collection as though I had every right to do so. Geraldine Satterfield was the addressee on a number of bills, Southern California Edison, AT&T, and Nordstrom among them. None of the envelopes was rimmed in red, so I assumed her accounts were current. A Pauline Fawbush had received her copy of People magazine, but that was the extent of the mail in her name. Impossible to know if it had been Geraldine or Pauline who'd answered the phone. The catalogs were for occupant or current resident. Nothing for Christian, but he'd only been a free man for a short while, assuming he was there at all. I didn't picture him on anybody's mailing list. I closed the box and moved on. On the far side of the street, I spotted two houses with for rent signs in the yards. One sign in small print read, "Do not disturb tenants," which suggested someone was still in residence. The house two doors to the right looked more promising. There were cardboard boxes piled up on the curb along with four bulging black plastic bags. There were also assorted discards, a chair with a spring poking up through the seat, and a swing-arm lamp with a missing locking nut and springs. This fairly cried out for further investigation. I lifted my gaze and did a casual survey. No dogs barked. I didn't pick up any cooking smells or the whine of a leaf blower being operated nearby. I traversed the street at an angle and walked up the short driveway, circling the house to the scruffy yard in the rear. I climbed two steps to the back porch and peered in through the glass-paned window in the kitchen door. The place was a mess. These people were never going to get their cleaning deposit back. The four-burner stove was spattered with grease. The counters were littered with open containers that ants were raiding in a feverish display of industry. In the center of the room, there was a garbage can filled to the brim. Even through the glass, the rotting foodstuff smelled like they'd been sitting for a week. I tried the knob, and the kitchen door swung open with a sort of creak reserved for horror movies. Technically speaking, this wasn't breaking and entering, since I hadn't broken anything. I made a few yoo-hoo noises just to satisfy myself that I was the only one on the premises. I'd seen this same floor plan in countless California cottages. Kitchen, living room, dining area, and two bedrooms with a bathroom between. I moved down the hall to the living room and looked out the front window toward the house at 401, which was hard to my right. I couldn't see much. I unlocked the deadbolt on the front door and stuck my head out. The front porch was small, surrounded on three sides by a half wall, bisected by a short flight of steps. White latticework trellises extended from the top of the low porch wall to the roofline. The vines that had originally climbed up the trellises were long since dead, and the brown leaves created a cozy retreat. The angle of the view was sharp, but it did encompass Geraldine Satterfield's front door and part of the driveway to the left. I closed the front door, which I left unlocked as I continued my walkabout. In the bathroom, I tried the taps and was delighted to find running water. I opened the toilet lid and discovered the little present left by the former tenant. I pushed the lever and was rewarded with a vigorous flushing. Despite the absence of toilet paper, a working commode is always an asset to a hard-boiled private eye. I left by way of the back door and went out to the street. I strolled to the corner where I turned right and returned to my car. I opened the trunk and hauled out a folding camp stool, suitable for golf or tennis matches, if I were the sort who attended sporting events. I opened the driver's side door, leaned across the seat, and flipped open the glove compartment. I removed my binoculars, locked the car, and then checked the parking signs to make sure the Honda wouldn't be towed away while I was on the job. Before I returned to the empty house, I went into the convenience store and picked up a turkey sandwich sealed in cellophane. The sell-by date wasn't coming up for another 2 days, so I figured I was safe. I opened the glass-fronted refrigerated case and chose a bottle of lemon-flavored iced tea. I added a 2-pack of 1-ply toilet paper and paid for the items at the cash register in front. I entered the empty house a second time by way of the back door, tested the toilet, which was still in good working order, then went out onto the front porch and assembled my temporary campsite. I opened the folding canvas stool and positioned it close to the trellis, set my bag of supper items to one side, and then trained my binoculars on the house at 4:01. I cursed myself when I realized I'd neglected to bring anything to read, which was probably just as well. This left me with no choice but to sit and stare through the X's of the trellis until I spotted my subject or gave up my quest for the day. As time passed to amuse myself, I divided the total hours on the job into the $200 I'd been paid. In calculating my hourly rate, I couldn't help but notice a steep decline as time went on. This is what I saw. A woman I took to be Pauline Faubush fetched the mail from the box and then settled on the porch in the floral upholstered chair and read her People magazine. Pauline appeared to be in her late 70s, and I was guessing she was Geraldine's mother and Christian's grandmother. She was occupied for 45 minutes, after which she returned to the house and came out moments later with her manicure kit. Oh, boy. I watched her paint her fingernails with a shade of polish called Love's Flame, the label clearly visible through my binoculars. At 5:00, a glossy black limousine appeared from my right, turned the corner onto Trace, and pulled into the Satterfield driveway. The driver was a middle-aged woman in a black pantsuit with a white dress shirt and a black bow tie. The rim on the license plate read, Prestige Transportation Services, Inc. From that, I surmised, she was a driver for a limousine company, a guess I later verified through other sources. She went into the house. I spotted her moments later in the kitchen, which was on the Dave Levine side of the street at the rear. Pauline joined her, and the two occupied themselves with preparing the evening meal. As they chopped at waist level, I couldn't identify any of the foodstuffs. I was about to pass out from boredom. Not that carrots would have been exciting. I ate my sandwich, which was better than I had any reason to expect. My neck hurt, I was cold, my butt was sore, and I was cranky. My right leg had fallen asleep. My hourly rate continued to drop precipitously. 92 cents an hour isn't even close to minimum wage. I saw the porch light go on. It was fully dark when I saw a fellow approach from the right on foot. He went into the house. In the murky light, I'd only caught a flash of him, but I recognized Christian Satterfield from his photograph. I waited another 30 minutes before I packed up my gear and decamped. I drove to the office and let myself in. I hauled out my portable Smith Corona and placed it on my desk. I removed the top of the hinged case and set it to one side. Then I pulled out a few sheets of letterhead stationery, along with a few pieces of blank paper that I used to compose a rough draft of my report, laying out the information in that faux neutral language that infuses a professional summary of a job when it's done. The report was short, but covered the information my client had requested. Christian's current address, a home phone, and visual confirmation that he was in Santa Teresa, and had entered the premises on at least this one occasion. My guess was that he'd gone back to living with his mom, but I might have been wrong about that. I reread the report, editing a line here and there. Then I rolled a sheet of stationery into the typewriter and made a proper job of it. I ran off two copies of the report on my new second-hand copy machine, signed the original, and folded it in thirds. The two copies I placed in the file folder I'd created for that purpose. I cranked a number 10 envelope into the machine and typed Hallie Betancourt's name and the post office box she'd provided. I affixed a stamp, snapped the lid onto the Smith Corona, and tucked it under the desk. Then I grabbed my shoulder bag and the report, turned out the lights, and locked up. On my way home, I stopped by the post office, where I pulled up at the curb and tossed the envelope into the collection box. Chapter 6. The rest of the week went by, the days filled with a sort of do-nothing business not worth mentioning. I should have savored the mindless passage of time, but how was I to know? Monday, March 13th, I went into the office as usual and diddled around until noon, taking care of clerical matters. I was halfway out the door on my way to lunch when the telephone rang. I hesitated, tempted to let the machine record the caller so I could be on my way. Instead, I reversed direction and dutifully picked up. Milhone Investigations. Ruthie laughed. Ha! I love that. Milhone Investigations. So businesslike. This is Ruthie. I was afraid you left for lunch.
I was just on my way out. How was your trip north?
Good. Actually, it was great. I enjoyed myself, she said. I was wondering if you'd had a chance to check the contents of that box.
Box?
I said, shit, I forgot. I'm sorry, honestly, I blanked on it. Well, I hate to nag, but I called the IRS agent this morning, and he was Johnny on the spot. My appointment's tomorrow afternoon at 1.
That was quick, I said.
Which IRS office, local or Los Angeles? He's coming to the house. I thought I'd have to make the trip downtown, but he says it's just as easy for him to stop by.
Accommodating of him?
Somewhat sheepishly, she said. I confess I was sucking up to him. I'm playing the poor widder woman with a lot of woe-is-me thrown in. I can't believe he fell for it.
You gotta work with what you have.
I'll say. Tell you the truth, he frightened me with all his talk of interest and penalties.
How much does Pete owe?
That's what the agent is trying to determine. He says failing to pay taxes is one thing. Failing to file is a federal offense. It's not like he wants to get me in hot water, just the opposite. If I come up with any documentation at all, he thinks he can get the issue resolved in my favor.
What issue? Is he talking about personal or professional?
Professional. But not the 1988 returns. He dropped that idea. I told him Pete had one client this entire past year, so he shifted gears. Now he's focused on Bird Shine.
That's ridiculous. Pete wasn't a partner in the agency. He wasn't even a full-time employee. It was all contract work. Who bothers to hang on to old 1099s?
I'm just repeating what he said. I don't want to argue with the man when I'm trying to pass myself off as a conscientious citizen. Pete swore he had access to all the old records, but they weren't close at hand.
When did he talk to Pete?
A year ago, I guess. He says Pete assured him he had the paperwork in storage. But it was a hassle to get to, and that's why he was dragging his feet.
It does sound like him.
Doesn't it? He never did anything he could put off.
I said, here's what seems weird.
As broke as he was, why would he shell out money for a storage unit?
Hadn't thought of that.
You think he lied?
Not my point. I'm saying if he'd rented a self-storage unit, you'd have heard about it by now unless he paid a year in advance. Otherwise, the renewal would have come up, don't you think?
True. I guess he might have stuck the paperwork in the attic. I mean, we don't really have an attic, but we have the equivalent.
Which is what?
Junk room might be the kindest way to describe it. Most of it's mine from when my mother died and we had to clean out her house.
Always possible Pete shoved a box or two in there. It would be easy to overlook.
Sounds like it's worth a try.
I've been meaning to do it anyway. I could use this space. Enough about my mess. I'd better let you get to lunch.
Don't worry about it. I'll do a quick search and get back to you within the hour. Will you be there?
I've got errands to run, but it shouldn't take me long. I'm not crazy about the idea of your using work time for this. Why don't you drop the box at my place and I can tackle the job? Play my cards right and I can probably talk the IRS guy into lending a hand. I could swear he was moments away from volunteering.
Well, aren't you the charmer? He's really falling all over himself. So what's this guy's name? If I get audited, I'll be sure to ask for him.
George Dayton, like the city in Ohio. You sure you won't change your mind about bringing the box to me?
No, I'll take care of it. I should have done it a week ago.
Well, I thank you. Let me know what you find.
I decided I might as well grab lunch at home, thus combining feed time with the task I'd forgotten. As I rounded the corner of the studio, I spotted Henry standing to one side of the yard in a white T-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. He has the long, lean lines of a distance runner, though I've never seen him engaged in formal exercise. He's a man in constant motion who keeps his intellect sharp by way of crossword puzzles and other tests of memory and imagination. The genetic code for all of the Pitts kids has tapped them for long lives. His brothers William and Louis share Henry's lean build. Charlie and Nell, now 97 and 99 years old respectively, are constructed along sturdier lines, but enjoy the same extended longevity. Charlie's hearing was dimmed, but the lot of them were smart, energetic, and mentally acute. I crossed to Henry's side and looked down, noting he'd dug a 12-inch deep hole in the lawn, into which he'd inserted a measuring stick. The cat sat nearby, staring attentively into the hole, hoping something small and furry would appear. Henry picked up his watering can, filled the hole with water, and took a quick look at his watch.
"What's this about?" I asked.
"I'm measuring soil perk. This dirt has heavy clay content, and I need to find out how fast the water drains."
I studied the water in the hole.
"Not very."
"I'm afraid not."
He glanced at me with a wry smile. "I made a discovery today. You know how Ed's been getting out?"
"No clue."
"Dryer vent. The tubing came loose, and I spotted the hole when I was crawling through the bushes checking water lines."
"You close it up?"
"I did. He'll probably find another way out, but for now he's housebound."
Apparently, Henry hadn't noticed the cat at his feet, and I made no mention of him. On a side table next to one of his Adirondack chairs, I spotted an oversized paper edition of Grissom's Gray Water Guide.
"I see you got your book."
"Came in Friday's mail. I've been reading up on the difference between separate flow and collection plumbing."
"What's that about?"
"Reuse efficiency, among other things. I've set up separate flows, but now I'm not sure that's the best choice. Grissom's talking about maintenance and troubleshooting, which hadn't occurred to me. This fellow's not a fan of the slapdash."
"Sounds like you need a plumber."
"Might," he said. "My house and yard are small, so I was hoping to minimize the cost. But there's no point in building a system that doesn't do the job."
"Wouldn't hurt to ask an expert."
"I'll give someone a call," he said.
He continued to stare at the water in the hole, which was, so far, stationary. He shook his head, disheartened.
"Yoo-hoo! Henry! Excuse me!"
Both of us turned to see a small, round face rising like a moon above the wood plank fence that separated Henry's driveway from the house next door. Henry lifted a hand in greeting.
"Edna! Good to see you! This is Kinsey."
"How do?" she said. "I heard voices and wondered if there was a problem."
Her face was framed by a thin braid she wore wound around her head. Her teeth, even at a distance, looked like a replacement set. She had thin shoulders and thin arms that she rested on the fence support. Her dress was black with tiny white dots and a wide white collar edged with lace. Under her collar, a red grosgrain ribbon was tied in a perky bow. I was surprised she was tall enough to peer over the fence.
"She's standing on a box," Henry said, half under his breath.
And to her,
"I'm explaining my water conservation plans." "I hope you'll share the information," she said. "Our water bill's been going up. I wish someone had told us how expensive it is living here. It's been a shock."
"Where were you before?" I asked.
"Perdido. My husband worked for the city. He took early retirement because of an injury. He receives his Social Security and disability checks, of course, but his pension doesn't go as far as we thought, and now we're feeling the pinch. Are you Henry's daughter?"
"His tenant. When he built his new garage, he converted the old one into a rental unit." She blinked.
"Well, that's a wonderful idea. Our garage is sitting empty. Joseph isn't allowed to drive, and I'm much too nervous on the road these days. With gas prices so high, it made sense to sell our car. A tenant would be a nice way to add to our income."
"I doubt you can get the necessary permits," Henry said. "Zoning laws have changed, especially with drought conditions getting worse. The city's tough on new construction."
"I don't know what we're to do," she said. "If an item's not on sale, I have to take it off the list. I never thought I'd see the day when I'd be clipping coupons."
"I do that as well," he said. "I make a game of it, seeing how much I can save from week to week. Sometimes I serve chili with chopped onions over cornbread as our main meal of the day. Fine as far as it goes, but 89 cents for a can of chili beans is too much," she said. "So-called land of plenty, and here you have little kids and old folks going hungry. It's not right."
"If you need to go to the market, I'll be happy to give you a lift the next time I go," Henry said,
riding right over her complaints. Her small face creased with a tremulous smile.
"That would be wonderful. I have one of those wire carts, but it's too far with my bad ankle."
"You put a list together. I'll be making a trip in the next couple of days." She turned to look at the house as though in response to a sound.
"Joseph's calling," she said. "I best go see what he needs. Nice meeting you, miss."
"You too," I said. She disappeared, and moments later we could see her struggle as she climbed her back porch stairs, clinging to the rail. "Bit of a sad sack," I remarked. Belatedly, he frowned.
"Aren't you home early?"
"I promised Ruthie I'd look for Pete's financial information. She's got an IRS audit tomorrow, and any relevant documents would be a blessing. I doubt I'll find 'em, but I said I'd try. There are some old birdshine files I need to sort through anyway."
"You need help?"
"Nah. It's one box. I should have done it days ago, but I forgot." He glanced back at the hole.
"Water's still sitting there."
"Bummer," I said. "Anyway, I told Ruthie I'd get back to her within the hour. Will I see you later at Rosie's?"
"I'm attending an adult education water conservation workshop at 7, but I'll stop by afterward."
I headed for my front door. I glanced back, noting that Ed the cat had taken himself inside and now sat on Henry's high bathroom windowsill, his mouth moving mutely in what I took to be a plaintive cry to be let out.
"You just stay where you are. I'm not letting you out," Henry said.
Chapter 7. I sat down at my desk and dragged the banker's box out of the knee-hole space. The lid was askew because the files were jutting up above the rim. It looked like someone had jammed the lid into place, trying to force a fit. Half the file tabs were bent and mangled in consequence. I lifted the box using the handhold on either end and set it on my desk. This was the same cardboard carton in which I'd found Pete's tape deck wedged some months before. I'd since moved the recorder to my bottom drawer. The old Sony was oversized and had the look of an antique compared to those currently in use. On the cassette he'd left in the machine, I found the illegally recorded phone conversation he'd used in the blackmail scheme that eventually got him killed. It really was a wonder he'd lived as long as he did. I emptied the box, hauling out file after file, bulging accordion-style folders, correspondence, case notes, and written reports. Bird Shine had a document retention policy of 5 years, so most were long out of date. The major portion would be duplicates of reports sent to the various attorneys for whom Ben and Morley had worked. My plan was to assess the contents, set aside anything sensitive, and deliver the remainder to a shredding company. I wasn't sure what would qualify as sensitive, but occasionally lawsuits drag on for years, and it was always possible a case might still be active, though no longer under the purview of the now-defunct agency. Pete must have cherry-picked these client files, perhaps hoping to generate business after the agency was dissolved. Given his questionable code of conduct, he would have felt no compunction about reaping the benefits of Ben and Morley's split. The 15 files I counted seemed randomly assembled. Pete probably had a game plan, but so far I hadn't discerned the underlying strategy. Among the cases, the only one I remembered was a lawsuit in which an attorney named Arnold Ruffner had hired Birdshine to do a background check on a woman named Taryn Sizemore, who was suing his client for intentional infliction of emotional distress. The defendant, Ned Lowe, was accused of stalking, harassment, and threats. His attorney paid Birdshine a big whack of money to find evidence that would undermine the plaintiff's credibility. Morley Shine had handled the matter. At the time, I was still in training, so I wasn't involved. Eventually, the suit was dropped, so Morley must have delivered the goods. Remembering Ruthie's caution about Pete's penchant for hiding cash, I turned each file upside down and riffled the pages. I wasn't even halfway through the process when a piece of folded graph paper fell out. I opened it and found myself looking at handwritten columns of numbers, 8 across and 12 down, the numbers grouped in subsets of 4. I checked the other side of the paper, which was blank. There were no torn edges, so it didn't appear the page had been removed from a financial ledger. No dollar signs, no commas, and no decimal points. Many numbers were repeated. 8 of the 12 lines ended in sets of zeros, which might have been placeholders used to round out the grid. I couldn't imagine what it was, but I assumed the data was significant, or why would he have hidden it? Knowing how devious he was, I didn't want to underestimate his thinking process, but I also didn't want to overestimate his smarts. I put the paper in the outer compartment of my shoulder bag and went back to the job at hand. I thought the case names I came across would trigger memories, but it was the sight of Ben Bird's precise penmanship that called up images of the past. He'd used a fountain pen and a particular brand of ink, so his field notes were easily distinguished from the scribbles Morley had made with assorted ballpoint pens. All the final reports were neatly typed. The originals had gone to the client's attorneys, and the carbons were filed in descending date order, the most recent on top. Ben had insisted on storing the rough draft notes with the finished versions, making sure both were retained. I could remember a couple of occasions when critical information hadn't made it into the typed report, and it was Ben's policy that had saved the agency embarrassment. He and Morley had been a study in contrasts. Ben was a statesman and a gentleman, tall, elegant, and dignified, while Morley was the rumpled, overweight jack-of-all-trades who generally flew by the seat of his pants. Morley relied on intuitive leaps, where Ben operated by the methodical accretion of detail. Morley was quick off the mark, and insights came to him intact. At the outset, he couldn't always justify his position, but 9 times out of 10, he was right. Ben might come to the same conclusion, but his was a carefully rendered composition where Morley's was a quick sketch. In one expandable file folder, I found a stack of annotated index cards, wrapped with a rubber band that broke the minute I lifted the packet from the depths. Ben Bird's bold blue cursive again. He was the one who taught me the art of the interview without the use of a notebook or tape recorder. Didn't matter to him if he was dealing with a client or a culprit, an adversary or a confidential informant. His policy was to listen with his whole being, mind open, judgment held in reserve. He absorbed tone and body language, trusting his memory as the conversation went on. After each exchange, he converted facts and impressions into written form as soon as possible, using index cards to record the bits and pieces, regardless of how unimportant they might have seemed in the moment. He was also an advocate of shuffling and reshuffling his makeshift deck of cards, convinced that even a random rearrangement would sometimes suggest a startling new view. Until that moment, I wasn't even aware how thoroughly I'd absorbed the lesson. I'd forgotten his habit of dating his index cards and decided it might be a smart idea to adopt the practice myself. I could see the virtue of keeping track of the order in which information was acquired along with the content itself. After that brief detour, I worked quickly, doing a spot check here and there, still hopeful I might find pertinent financial statements. That Pete might slip personal business papers in among agency documents made no particular sense, but I didn't want to rule out the possibility. The folders themselves were shop-worn, tabs ragged and bent, a consequence of the boxes being too shallow for the contents. Since bankers' boxes are designed to accommodate standard-size files, I was perplexed by the poor fit. I studied the bottom of the empty box, noting that the cardboard floor was uneven along the edge. I'd constructed many identical cartons, which arrived in flat packages for assembling in place. There were always tricky diagrams labeled Flap A and Flap B, with arrows pointing this way and that. I thought of it as an IQ test for office employees whose job was to pack up documents for long-term storage. The puzzler was that the final flap should have fit seamlessly, and here it did not. I retrieved a letter opener from my pencil drawer and wedged it into the gap, using it as leverage. I cringed at the harsh shriek of cardboard on cardboard, but did succeed in popping out the makeshift rectangle that had been cut to fit. Under it was a 10x15 padded mailing pouch addressed to a Father Xavier, St. Elizabeth's Parish in Burning Oaks, California, a small town 125 miles northeast of Santa Teresa. The return address was 461 Glen Rock Road, also in Burning Oaks. The package was postmarked March 27, 1961, roughly 28 years before. I removed the mailer and steadied it front and back. Originally, the padded envelope had been taped and stapled shut, but someone had already opened it, so I felt at liberty to take a peek myself. Inside, there were a number of items that I removed one by one. The first was a red bead rosary. The second, a small Bible with a red leatherette cover embossed with Lenore Redfern, Confirmed to Christ, April 13, 1952. The name was written again on the frontispiece in a girlish cursive. Knowing little about the Catholic Church, I imagined young girls were baptized or confirmed at age 12 or so. I wasn't sure if baptism and confirmation were synonymous or different religious rituals, but I thought the taking of a First Communion figured in there somewhere. I reached into the mailer again and removed a crude, handmade card on red construction paper. The simple lettering read, "Happy Mother's Day." In the center, there was a child's diminutive handprint outlined in white tempera paint with the name April printed under it, doubtless under the guiding hand of an adult. At the bottom of the mailer was an unsealed envelope that contained a child's birthday card. On the front was a teddy bear holding a balloon with a button affixed. The button read, "Now I am 4. Inside, the handwritten message read, "I love you with all my heart. XOXOXOX, Mommy." 4 $1 bills had been enclosed, one for every year of the child's life. I returned to the Bible, where I found a black-and-white snapshot tucked into the New Testament. The young girl pictured wore a white dress, a headband with a short white veil attached, white socks edged with lace, and black patent leather Mary Janes. She was posed on the front steps of a church. Dark hair, dark eyes, and a smile that revealed endearingly crooked teeth. In the current context, I thought I was safe assuming this was Lenore Redfern. Tucked in the back cover of the Bible, almost as an afterthought, I found a wedding announcement, dated March 13, 1988, clipped from the Santa Teresa Dispatch. Lowe Stallings. April Elizabeth Lowe and Dr. William Bryan Stallings were united in marriage on February 20, 1988, at the United Methodist Church in Santa Teresa, California. April, the daughter of Ned and Celeste Lowe of Cottonwood, is a 1981 graduate of Pomona College and more recently the Santa Teresa Business College. She's currently employed as a legal secretary for the law firm of Eaton and McCarty. Mr. Stallings is the son of Dr. Robert Stallings and the late Juliana Stallings of Boulder, Colorado. A graduate of the University of California, Santa Teresa, and Loma Linda University School of Dentistry. Dr. Stallings opened a private practice specializing in orthodontics, with an office on State Street in Santa Teresa. The newlyweds honeymooned in Hawaii and are now at home in Colgate. April, not yet 4 years old when the items were mailed to Father Xavier, had done all right in the world. She'd managed to educate herself, find gainful employment, and fall in love. I read the wedding announcement again and stopped 3 sentences into it at the mention of the bride's father. Ned Lowe was the defendant in the lawsuit I'd just come across. I was assuming Ned Lowe was April's father and Lenore Redfern was her mother. Ned was now married to a woman named Celeste, so if Ned and Lenore were April's parents, they'd either divorced or Lenore had died and he'd moved on. Pete must have spied the announcement in the paper and added it to the old file, creating an addendum to the now dead legal dispute. The remaining item was a 4x6-inch red leather frame that contained a studio portrait of a mother posed with a little girl sitting on her lap. The mother-daughter relationship was reinforced by the fact that the two wore matching red plaid tops. The little girl's wispy blonde curls were shoulder-length, and her face was lighted by a smile that showed small, perfect teeth. She held an Easter basket in her lap that contained a big blue bunny, dyed Easter eggs, one pink, one blue, one green, and assorted foil-wrapped chocolates nested in bright green paper grass. Lenore and April? I put the two photographs side by side. Lenore at her confirmation and Lenore with her child. The grown-up Lenore bore only a passing resemblance to her younger self. Her hair was now blonde and worn in a style vaguely suggestive of vintage movie star glamour. She must have been in her late teens or early 20s. Her pale complexion was so smooth and clear, it might have been carved from alabaster. Her expression was withdrawn. Anger turned inward, as though motherhood had somehow robbed her of animation. The contrast between mother and daughter was troubling. The camera had caught the child close to bouncing, happy and secure, and utterly unaware of her mother's demeanor. I returned the items to the pouch, and then returned the pouch to the bottom of the box and wedged the cardboard panel in on top. I assumed Pete had created the hidey hole, though I couldn't be sure. I shoved the batch of files into the box in no particular order. I wondered how these keepsakes had ended up in his hands so many years after the fact, especially when they'd been mailed to a Catholic priest. Pete, of course, was a mercenary at heart, and may have intended to deliver the memorabilia to the newly wed April and accept a reward if she should press one on him in gratitude. The notion was crass, but in perfect keeping with his character. I placed the banker's box near the front door. In the morning, I'd take it to the office and lock the mailing pouch in my floor safe. I couldn't imagine who'd want it. But if Pete thought it worth concealing, then I'd do the same. At that point, for lack of a better plan, I put a call through to Ruthie. The number rang repeatedly, and then her answering machine picked up. I listened to the outgoing message, and after the beep I said, "Hey, babe, no tax returns and no financial records. Sorry about that." I'll be trotting up to Rosie's in a bit, so if you feel like joining me, I'll buy you a drink and we can catch up.
Chapter 8. As I'd forgotten to eat lunch, I prepared a nutritious dinner at home. A peanut butter and pickle sandwich on a multi-grain bread so textured I could count the seeds, nuts, hulls, and bits of straw baked into the loaf. I rounded out the fiber content with a handful of Fritos while I sipped a Diet Pepsi. At 8, I grabbed the banker's box and rested it on my hip while I locked the studio door behind me. As I passed my car, I unlocked the trunk and hefted the box into the space, locking the car again before I continued the half block to Rosie's. William was at his usual post behind the bar, looking chipper in a three-piece navy suit with a pale blue dress shirt, no tie. He'd donned a white apron, and he was polishing wine glasses with a special microfiber cloth he favored for eradicating water spots. When he saw me, he lifted a hand in greeting. He placed a glass on the bar, filled it with white wine from one of Rosie's oversized screw-top jugs, and then winked to let me know the glass was meant for me. I crossed to the bar and settled on a stool. "How are you doing, William?"
"Good. How are you?"
"Good. Thanks for this," I said as I lifted the wine glass.
"My treat,"
he said, and then lowered his voice. "Rosie suggested no tie tonight. If you think it's disrespectful to the other patrons, just say the word."
"William, you're the only one in here who ever wears a tie, so it might be a relief."
"I appreciate that." He glanced to his left, where one of the day drinkers had bellied up and was now signaling for his usual. William poured two fingers of Old Crow and walked it down the bar. I turned on my stool. Anna Dace was seated at a table at the rear in the company of two girlfriends, one dark, one fair. Given the chill March evening, all three seemed too scantily dressed, tank tops, miniskirts, and high heels. They had their heads together, and Anna seemed to be reading the palm of the blonde, who appeared to be the younger of the two girls. I watched her trace a line along the blonde's thumb, speaking earnestly. Nothing so fascinating as being the focus of someone else's rapt attention. Monday nights are quiet in most neighborhood watering holes, but the recent influx of police personnel opened the door to chance encounters with officers I didn't usually have occasion to run into. A case in point being Jonah Robb, who sat in a booth by himself. I eased off my perch and crossed the room. "You up for company?"
"Of course. Have a seat."
"It's good to see you," he said. I slid into the booth across from him.